The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Morning glory, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That picking you here is Lester Flatt, who hails from Sparta, Tennessee. A new affiliate on the Hugh Hewitt Show is News Talk 1050 in Sparta. Added up on yesterday. I said, well, I never got, you're asking, I know you're asking, did you get to play with him? No, I never got to play with Lester. Never crossed paths, and I'm looking at a picture of him, though, monument to him in the middle of Sparta, Tennessee, on Main Street at Liberty Square. And I admired his music. Flatt and Scruggs, you all know that, you should. But I'm so happy to be on in his hometown of Sparta, Tennessee. Good morning, Sparta. Your Senator Bill Hagerty will be on with us a little bit later today on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I think you become 421. I'm not sure how many affiliates we have. They grow in number. Mike Gallagher is green with envy every day that that happens, and that's okay, Mike. Don't worry about it. You do well. You do well, and for a boy from Dayton, you're doing okay. We appreciate you. Turbulent night for our new listeners in Sparta on News Talk 1050. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and what I normally do is begin every single day, every single show with a rundown of the big news called The Rundown. And the reason is some people only have 8 minutes for their news. And if they listen to the rundown that I post every day at HughHewitt.com and at my YouTube channel and on Spotify and iTunes and all that, The Rundown is this first segment in every interview I do. If you want, you just want the news, this is what you listen to. By now, you will know that they had a killing of an unarmed, suspected arrest dodger. Guy was running from the cops after he'd been stopped, got back into his car. His name is Dante Wright. And Dante Wright, two afternoons ago, was shot and killed by a police officer as he fled from police. It seems to me the accounts are a little bit difficult to read, but it appears as though he got out of his car, and then when the officer said, we've got an arrest warrant for you, he got back into the car, and she intended to tase him, and she instead shot and killed him. He drove a while and crashed. Minnesota police chief says officer shot and killed black man in error, and that is according to the Financial Times. The New York Post says body cam footage of police shooting of Dante Wright was released. It was difficult to watch. Minnesota police officer who shot Dante Wright, according to the Washington Post, exclaimed, oh, blank, I shot him. Female, and she is a 27-year veteran of the force. Her name was released earlier today. What we know about it is, according to Chief Tim Gannon of the Brooklyn Center Police Department, officers pulled Mr. Wright over on Sunday afternoon for a traffic violation related to expired registration tags. Officers then discovered that he had a warrant for his arrest. As the police tried to detain Mr. Wright, he stepped back into his car, prompting a brief struggle with officers. In graphic body footage shown to reporters on Monday, this is from the New York Times, one officer can be seen pointing a handgun at him and shouting, "Taser!" After the car pulls away, the officer yells an obscenity and says, "I shot him," to two other officers, according to the video. The car traveled several blocks, struck another vehicle. The police and medical workers pronounced Mr. Wright dead on the scene. Quote, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet, Chief Gannon said. This appears to me, from what I viewed, and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. Brooklyn City Mayor made some remarks, and after that, the Brooklyn City Manager called for due process for the police officer, and he was fired immediately thereafter because that is apparently not his job to call for due process. And it might not be his job to call for due process. His job, city managers, honestly, they're supposed to be seen at city council meetings and no other time, basically, unless it's an emergency services. Well, they had riots last night. Of course, we expected that. I said that yesterday, and they were fairly large, and they went on until about midnight. The curfew was at 7 p.m. last night, and the Star Tribune of the Twin Cities reports that it's not expected to change. It just went on and on for a long period of time, and no one was killed. Whether or not injuries occurred, I cannot tell you, but the unrest was prolonged. Tear gas used, dozens of arrests were made, military vehicles rumbled down city streets as businesses hastily closed, and it's going to be a rough week. All right, so Governor Tim Walz issued a curfew in Hennepin, Ramsey, and Dakota counties from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m., but that was not honored. It was honored in the breach in and around Brooklyn City. And we'll keep you posted on it. Meanwhile, the Virginia Attorney General has launched a civil rights probe of the Black Army officer's violent traffic stop, which many of you have seen. I think he was a captain for some reason. I think he was a captain. Was pulled over and refused to get out of the car. And when he got out of the car, was assaulted. And many people, Karen Nazario, Army Second Lieutenant. Okay, I thought he was a captain. Army Second Lieutenant Karen Nazario pulled over because his newly purchased SUV lacked a permanent license plate, held at gunpoint, pepper sprayed, struck, and handcuffed. A temporary tag was taped to his window. Nazario said in a federal lawsuit that he filed against officers. Calls have been mounting for an independent investigation of the controversial police-involved incidents in Virginia in recent months, and so the Virginia AG has launched one. So that's the domestic news. Let's give you some good news. COVID-19 drug, Regeneron, pharmaceutical drug, prevents symptomatic disease in a study. Now, that's good because not everyone can get the vaccine. Get the vaccine. Go around, check today, check your website. It's the best thing to have. If you'll notice the ridiculous Christopher Guest hair that I had yesterday and Christopher Lloyd hair that I had yesterday is all gone. Got to the barber yesterday. It was a wonderful thing to go back to the barber, vaccinated. She still wore a mask, and I didn't. Because cutting your hair with a mask is kind of hard, but she understood I was good to go. And I don't know if she's been vaccinated or not, but I'm not worried about it. And now if you haven't been vaccinated and you've got the antibody showing you've got it, they can give you this new drug from Regeneron and 81% better results. People don't develop symptoms. So it's a preventative application. So if you're feeling poorly, get you to a hospital. Do not sit around at home and wait and see whether it gets worse, because if you can get it early, my friend Dave Zavagno in Cleveland just likes to say the biggest mistake was we did not encourage people to get care early. We told them to stay away from hospitals for fear of spreading it, and we could have nipped so many of the deaths in the bud, but you learn as you go along in a pandemic. Nobody's fault. Nobody learned anything. Inflation likely gained steam in March as economic recovery gained steam in March. Wall Street Journal this morning, U.S. consumer prices picked up sharply in March as the economic recovery gained momentum. We expect the Labor Department to report the price index jumping today. We will see. Important story in the Wall Street Journal as well. Americans have too much toilet paper. Yes, that's true. After a year in which toilet paper shortages left consumers scrambling for squares, sales are plummeting to below pre-pandemic levels. I don't think we're using the bathroom less. I just think we've got enough supply of toilet paper to last for a year. Meanwhile, that nuclear facility in Natanz in Iran, it blew up somehow. They lost power, caused much of damage. It set back their program by 9 months. They are, of course, blaming Israel, who's not saying anything, of course, which means exactly what you think it means. Do not screw around with the Israelis. Prince Harry is going off to the funeral. China has a message for America, according to the Wall Street Journal. We're an equal now. They're not, but they're very strong. Ant, Chinese holding company led by Jack Ma, the wealthiest private sector individual, has been ordered to restructure by Chinese regulator. Jack Ma is feeling his oats. A court in Xinjiang will hear a defamation case against a German researcher who accused Beijing of human rights abuses in the area. Of course, there's nothing to see here. All these people in concentration camps with head shaved. And President Xi is going to attend a two-day virtual summit on climate, hosted by Joe Biden and John Kerry. I am expecting it any day now that we will exchange recognition of China's ridiculous nine-dash line for climate reductions promised in March of 2080. Uber posted a record demand in March. We are back, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, especially to Sparta, Tennessee, 1050 News Talk, 1050, our new affiliate. David Drucker joins us once a week. He's on the Washington Examiner team, and you see him on Fox News. In fact, you see him all over cable. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Good morning.
Yesterday, Judge David Carter, late last night, got a motion for a preliminary injunction in the homelessness case in California. Going to be a big deal. I mean, a big, big deal. Not sure you're going to get sent to California, but I hope you get to spend a couple of nights on Skid Row to cover that.
Yeah, look, this is a big story. It could be both a big story in 2022 in the midterm elections, but also, you know, there's a possibility of a recall campaign in California. And this has been an ongoing problem there, exacerbated by the pandemic. And, you know, either nobody's figured out what to do or they figured it out and they don't want to do what's necessary to fix this. And this case has been, you know, one of the few things that has the potential to shake things up out there in terms of how homelessness is dealt with. And it's a problem that was bad even in the midst of a really good economy, and it's only gotten worse.
Yeah, plaintiffs have asked the judge to seize all the Proposition 8, Prop HHH. There are billions of dollars in the stimulus money and to go to work. And so, and to appoint a special master, we will see what he does. But you're a Californian. You would stand out a little bit, David. David is known for our new listeners in Sparta, Tennessee, as being something of a dapper dresser. He would stand out on Skid Row a little bit. Drucker, I wanted to talk to you about Sean Parnell. You wrote a story that Selena Zito told me about yesterday that I did not know. Sean Parnell is going to run for the Pennsylvania Senate seat, left vacant by the retiring Pat Toomey.
It looks like it. I think what's interesting about this is he has been getting a lot of encouragement from Trump world, but also has a sort of pedigree and background that could be appealing to more traditional-minded Republicans. He's got Donald Trump Jr.'s endorsement in his pocket, ready to go. This is something that I reported on a couple of months ago, or February, it seems like a couple of months. And so he would immediately start with that. He would launch a campaign, and Donald Trump Jr.'s endorsement is probably second best to his father's endorsement. His father would probably hang back, watch the field and see what he wanted to do, but he would have the second most important Trump. And if he can, you know, fix some of the mistakes from his first campaign, and if he can, not so much in a Republican primary, but if he's nominated, if he can overcome the potential challenge of explaining why he opposed certification of Pennsylvania's votes on January 6th, he's a really formidable candidate. And, of course, with a Democrat in the White House, this should be a good year for Republicans to hold a Senate seat in Pennsylvania.
Now, I am wondering about the Trump strategy for the family, because President Trump endorsed Mo Brooks, who's been on. We should just start calling him Senator Brooks because he's going to win. But he didn't endorse in Ohio, and he hasn't endorsed in Missouri. I don't think he's going to endorse Eric Greitens. There's no upside for him there because he doesn't want to endorse. There's only downside for the president endorsing. If he loses one, the myth is broken. So you pick the safe one. Is Laura Trump or Ivanka Trump going to run in either North Carolina or Florida, respectively? I really can't see Ivanka doing that in Florida, but I don't know much about Laura.
Right. So Ivanka's already said no in Florida. And the president endorsed Marco Rubio last week. So that one's a done deal. I think North Carolina is the more interesting case because Laura hasn't ruled it out. The polling looks good for her, but there are a lot of capable conservatives that are running in the Republican primary. And I think one of the things we've seen with Trump, and it's sort of it's in tension with what we think are, you know, his designs to remake the Republican Party and his image, is he doesn't like to endorse in primaries and lose. And he loses on occasion, right. Not often, but he does lose on occasion. So I think when he's looking at an uncertain field like Ohio and an uncertain field like North Carolina, and we don't know yet what's going on in a couple of other key states, I think he likes to hang back and sort of see how things develop so he can either put somebody over the top or just ensure that whoever he's endorsing was going to win anyway. And he can chalk it up as a victory. And part of this is understandable, right? I mean, if you endorse a bunch of people that lose, your endorsement starts to become meaningless and in some cases laughable. And that's the last thing the president wants. And it's very interesting because for Republicans that just want to win general elections, one of the things that they lean on to reassure themselves is that, look, President Trump doesn't want to endorse losers. And therefore, he'll probably come around to the same candidate that, for instance, Mitch McConnell thinks should win a primary, because they, in that regard, they both have the same interest.
Yeah, there is no upside in losing a primary for the president. That is where you lose one or two of those and then people don't care anymore.
Correct. And, you know, especially for this president, in many regards, he's just not an ideologue. He just wants to win and be perceived as a winner, where, you know, over the years, Hugh, we've covered a lot of conservatives that are willing to, you know, take a flyer in a primary or stake out the unpopular position with a candidate because they're true believers and they're trying to push the party in a certain direction.
Yeah, he is not the club for growth. David Drucker, always a pleasure. Follow him on Twitter, Sparta, Tennessee, and everywhere else. David M. Drucker on Twitter with the Washington Examiner. Coming right back, America, stay tuned. Hour number two is Byron York and Admiral Stavridis. Don't do anything except stay right there on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you this. There has never been a more important time to protect your digital rights. That's why I and thousands of my patriotic listeners choose to secure our online data by using ExpressVPN. Do you believe that a VPN isn't for you because you can use the internet just fine without one? Anytime you go online, my friends, your internet service provider can see every site you are visiting. You think that VPNs are complex and only for tech experts? No, they're not. Trust me. With ExpressVPN, you launch the app, tap one button to protect yourself, and it's done. It's that simple. I trust ExpressVPN to protect my online data because they're rated number one by CNET and Wired, and they stand for my values. So now is the time for you to take a stance. Take back your privacy at expressvpn.com/Hewitt. You get 3 extra months for on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 extra months free. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and greetings especially to our brand new affiliate in Sparta, Tennessee. You will be lucky and happy to know that we have Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News join us most Tuesdays. He is with us this morning. He's just back from the border, and his Washington Examiner story is headlined, "The Border is Even Worse Than You Think." Hello, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing fine, thanks.
Now, I think it's pretty bad. Did you see border czar Kamala Harris when you were down there?
You know, I looked and looked and looked, but she was not there. And it's actually pretty obvious why she is not there, which is if she went, she would draw attention to just enormous failures, one after the other, by this administration. I just think it's no secret that no politician would want to go and take a big group of press with her and say, here, look, we're failing here, and we're failing here, and we're failing here. So,
now, Byron, where did people like to know what a reporter's life is like? Where did you go, and how long did you stay at each of those places?
I went. There was a Republican group led by Representative Steve Scalise that went to the border. It was a quick 2-day trip. Left on Thursday, got back on Friday night, and basically went and they. This is a group of 10 Republican House members, had briefings with Border Patrol, with Texas state officials, because they're trying to, I'll explain why they're involved in this. And then went to, this was in, I should say, in McAllen, Texas, and in Mission, Texas, which is one of the worst spots now. And the takeaway from this, the takeaway is the government's response to this incredible surge of illegal border crossers is entirely improvised. I mean, it is totally jury-rigged. They are scrambling to deal with this. And the reason they're scrambling to deal with this is that President Biden, on his first days in office, just threw out the foundation of the way the government deals with migrants with nothing ready to replace it. He just threw out the system but had nothing to put in its place. And so we went, one of the first stops we went on Thursday night was there's a bridge, and I will butcher the pronunciation of it, the Anzaldúas International Bridge. It joins the United States and Mexico. And there's a large underpass on the U.S. side, and the Americans have created this makeshift processing station there. It operates 24/7. A lot of people arrive at night. It's about a mile or a mile and a half from the banks of the Rio Grande. So migrants are left by their smugglers on the bank. They walk through the woods and then around a dirt road with an arrow sign pointing them to the bridge, and they appear out of the darkness. We were there about 11 o'clock or midnight. They just appear out of the darkness, one group after the other, small groups, four or five people, two or three adults, often carrying children, really small children or other smaller children walking with them. They arrive, U.S. officials get their rudimentary information. It's just a bunch of benches and fences and porta potties and some medical units. They sit through the night silently. They're exhausted and filthy. They wait for a bus that will take them to the Donna Center, which is this dangerously overcrowded. We've finally seen pictures of it. Dangerously overcrowded detention center in Donna, Texas, nearby. And they'll be stuck there for who knows how many days, maybe a week, maybe 10 days. And then at some point, the government will send them to, the U.S. government will send them to some place in the country at the McAllen Airport. You see small groups of migrants, lots of them, and they have manila envelopes. And on the envelopes, there are some messages printed in English, like, I do not speak English. Can you please help me to get on my plane? And their flight information, and then they're off to someplace in Indiana or someplace in Colorado, someplace in Virginia. And that's how the government is handling this. There was no effort. I never saw any effort to stop anyone from crossing illegally into the United States. The Biden administration is trying only to process this flow as quickly as they can and release migrants into the United States.
Is there any transparency into how it is decided where they are going? I'm actually afraid that some of these people are going into enslavement because, you know, human trafficking, as demonstrated from places as remote as the BBC series Shetland, is worldwide. and people pay thousands of dollars to get to the United States, but then they have to work off the cost of that, and they can set up elaborate networks about who they are alleging is family. Is there any effort made to verify whom they say is family?
We were told, and we specifically asked about this, we were told by officials who probably wouldn't want to be named, that the U.S. officials do not have the resources to do that, and they are not doing it. So in other words, if you come in and you have you can tell officials that you have relatives or family or a friend who lives at 123 Main Street in Terre Haute, Indiana, they don't really check it out much. They do their best to get you on your way. And I'm just
astonished by this, Byron. I understand the border is a difficult problem because they changed all the messaging. They changed all the agreements. They brought this on the United States. Correct. And they brought it on these poor people. Let's just stipulate that. Once they're here, I do not understand indifference to where they are going, because we know how the cartels operate. And we know that many of these people are going into bondage. And the United States is stepping back and saying, we don't care. We just got to get rid of the picture, right?
Yeah, they're just trying to process the flow. And what has happened, when you talk to Border Patrol people, they're law enforcement people, and it's very clear that in their heart of hearts, what they want to do is catch bad guys. I mean, they like the idea of catching smugglers who are trying to bring, bales of marijuana or packs of cocaine into the country. They want to catch bad guys. And what instead, they are being diverted to helping process families, and some of them refer to it as babysitting. Huge, huge percentages of the Border Patrol force is now, instead of securing the border, just trying to process this flow, get people's names, information, and keep them clothed and fed and everything until they could be released into the United States. And meanwhile, by the way, that creates big gaps, which is what Governor Abbott, and I was in Texas this whole time, Governor Abbott of Texas has created something called Operation Lone Star, in which Texas state officials try to fill in some of the gaps of Border Patrol people who aren't patrolling the border, and using state officials to do that because the situation is so bad.
Byron, in the aftermath of the fall of South Vietnam in 1975, I guess it is, Fetching Mrs. Hewitt was a child in Fallbrook at that time in high school, and recalls the operation that was staged at Camp Pendleton. There were hundreds of thousands of South Vietnamese who came to the United States and went to Camp Pendleton and were housed in tents and fed by the Marines and placed systematically. We did it with the Mariel Boatlift as well. It can be done. If we're going to accept these people, I just don't want people being turned over into human slavery and trafficking, sometimes sex trafficking, sometimes just physical labor and horrific conditions. And if people don't know that's going on, they're just blind to it. It's going on.
In the Vietnam situation, of course, you're describing a United States government effort to actually bring people here. They weren't, arriving in inner tubes on the coast of California. This is something different, and you're not seeing that systematic effort because, again, I cannot emphasize enough, Joe Biden threw out the system, the Remain in Mexico agreement, the asylum agreements with the Northern Triangle countries. He's gutted Title 42. In addition, of course, he promised no deportations for 100 days, and he's stopped the border wall cold. So he's done all of these things, substantive acts and rhetorical acts to attract people here. By the way, it is funny. I would say that the border right now is crawling with Republican lawmakers who are going down there to see what's going on, and there are zero Democrats lawmakers who are trying to find out what's
going
on.
And very little media. I know my friend Jake Soboroff will eventually get down there because he genuinely does care, but I don't know if the producers at MSNBC will let him go because this is not part of the narrative, and therefore the narrative is not allowed to show it. Byron York, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Byron York. Come right back. DC, there are a whole bunch of Teslas out there, and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I were talking about, where do you charge them? And apparently you charge them in your garage. Dwayne, do you have a charging station in your garage yet for your scooter?
Well, I have battery charges for my bikes, yes, but we actually have a BMW X5, which is a hybrid vehicle that also has a electric motor that we do plug into the garage.
Wait a minute, but where do you put your scooters?
I have electric bicycles that are in the garage.
They're in the garage, and so do the scooters plug into the wall and then they're charged?
Yes, they're just like a battery charger for a screwdriver, something that you know nothing about
and
either.
So the same charge that works for the scooter works on a BMW?
No, it's a completely different charging system for my bicycles.
There you go. The scooter and the BMW need different plugs.
They both plug into normal wall outlets. I don't know what you're talking about.
You said just that you're contradicting yourself. This is why producers are of no use whatsoever. They've confused my friends in Sparta. That's Dwayne. He came in today, so I wanted you to make sure that you heard him because it's like a once a week thing. If you used to listen to Rush and you're listening to me now, God rest his soul, may he rest in peace. He had Mr. Snerdly. I've got Dwayne. And Dwayne comes in once a week, and when he does, I want you to know he's here. So he's here today. We got Adam every day and Ben and Harley most days, but they're like frickin' frack. Stay tuned. See, that music means we're joined by Admiral James Stavridis. He is retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander in NATO, former head of Southern Command. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. How's it going?
Good, good, good. Now, I think your book, 2034, is going to continue to sell because of a headline which is in front of me from the South China Morning Post. U.S.-China relations, military tensions continue to rise over Taiwan. And then in the Navy Times yesterday, China's Navy has more ships than the U.S. Does it matter? They have announced a ship fleet size of 360 battle force ships compared to our 297. That's why 2034 is going to continue to sell, Admiral. Your reaction to those two headlines?
I'm worried. And I'll add a third headline, which is over the past weekend, China flew at least 25 combat aircraft over the Taiwan Straits into the aircraft identification zone, the most they have flown in since Taiwan started recording it. So this is real. They're putting more and more pressure on Taiwan. And a lot of my friends, you know, senior retired military, active duty military have said, oh, Stavridis, you wrote a great book, except you got one thing wrong, the date. It's actually going to be much sooner than that. So, yeah, I'm increasingly worried.
There are 80,000 Russian troops on the border of East Ukraine where and Crimea, where they occupied under President Obama. I think they sense weakness on the United States side. A call between Xi and Putin saying, you know, organizing dates would not surprise me. What do we do or what could we do if China attacked Taiwan? There's not much we can do if Russia moves further into Ukraine. There just isn't. There's just not much we can do. What can we do? Can we sink the Chinese fleet?
We can go to combat. We can sink many Chinese vessels. In the process of doing that, we'll also lose some of our vessels. This will be a very difficult fight. Think the Falklands, where our surface ships will be flooding in. They'll be subject to long-range air attacks from land aircraft. Yeah, I think it would be a bloody battle. Could we actually stop an invasion? I think we probably could, but it's a very narrow margin, Hugh. And don't take my word for it. The commander of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Phil Davidson, testified on this about 3 weeks ago in an open session. And he said he sees the possibility of a Chinese actual invasion of Taiwan in the next 6 years. So again, it's a real scenario. Our planners in Honolulu, where the headquarters of Indo-Pacific Command is located, grapple with this every day. They look at the real intelligence. And I'll close by saying the U.S. needs to decide and move away from what we currently have, which is called a policy of strategic ambiguity, which means, in a nutshell, we're not going to tell China exactly what we're going to do. I think on this one, it's time to strongly consider telling China an armed invasion of Taiwan is not acceptable to the United States. We will go to combat to stop that.
Now, Admiral, there are three big signals that have recently been given. First, Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan went to Anchorage and got yelled at and insulted. Then there was a story floated and retracted about our boycotting the Beijing Olympics. And then there was a story floated in the New York Times. Had to come out of state. Had to be authorized by Secretary Blinken, if I know my New York Times sourcing, suggesting that maybe we have to move away from strategic ambiguity to something, but not doing so. And so I think we have a very tremulous, if I can use that word, new administration that doesn't quite want to go forward. Meanwhile, I have a story that President Xi has announced he's going to go to John Kerry's virtual summit on climate change, which is wholly beside the point, in my view. It's almost counterproductive. How would you communicate the collapse of strategic ambiguity and the embrace of purpose in we will resist, we will assist Taiwan, and we will resist?
I would start by building it from the ground up, Hugh. So in other words, instead of on a Tuesday morning saying that's the end of strategic ambiguity, I would build it up as follows. I would increase the weapons systems capability that we afford to the Taiwanese. I would increase the level of visitors going. So have the new Secretary of the Navy, when you appoint him or her, the first person to go to Taiwan. I would allow Taiwan to display their flag and wear military uniforms if they're military officers when meeting with their counterparts in the United States. I would invite higher level Taiwanese officials. So I would be ratcheting that up. And at the same time, I'd be telling Taiwan through closed doors that, you know, we're looking very seriously at this. The way you approach Taiwan will make a difference. And if China continues, as I think they will, to simply push hard against the Taiwanese, then I think by the time you've built that scaffolding, then you make the announcement. It's probably 6 months to a year from now.
Do the People's Liberation Army, Navy know what we can do to them? I mean, do they have an idea of our best weaponry?
Absolutely. And that's probably the reason they haven't invaded the island of Taiwan. They know that we have not only the forward capability with our aircraft carriers, would have to be careful in how rapidly we get them within range of Chinese air. But, you know, we're smart. We know how far a Chinese attack jet and a Chinese cruise missile can go. Probably start a little bit further out, send in unmanned systems, cruise missiles, take out, roll back, as the term is, the Chinese air defense, their anti-access air defense systems, A2AD. Then you roll the carriers in. China really doesn't have a good answer to that. What they are doing is two things: cyber, offensive cyber, something we bring out in 2034, and also hypersonic cruise missiles. In other words, it's simply a fancy word for they go 5 or 6, 7 times faster than the current generation. We don't have a good answer for those yet. We're working on both of those sides of the coin as well. That's going to be job one in the Pentagon in terms of weapons procurement.
Now, we have two classes of submarines. One is strategic, one is tactical. The tactical we call attack submarines. Attack submarines do what their name says, they attack. How many of those do you think we have in or around the South China Sea that could strike PLAN targets if they moved on Taiwan?
Well, on day one, we probably, I don't want to get into specific numbers, if you don't mind, simply because I know exact numbers and I don't want to try and fuzz them up in my head. Let me say this. The advantage of the U.S. Navy is, as the British said, the sea is one, meaning we can flood the zone, no pun intended on the word flood. We can move a lot of our attack boats in there very quickly. These are magnificent machines of war. They can go 30 plus knots under the ocean. That means you're going to travel almost 1,000 miles a day. We can flood that zone pretty damn quickly and have an awful lot of those attack boats in there. That's key to this strategy as well, because that's an area in which we truly overmatch the Chinese, is undersea warfare technology.
Now, former Deputy Secretary, National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger said on the Nixon seminar last week, a week ago tonight, that we also have the ability through our banking institutions to shutter the Chinese economy, that we can just kill their credit. They depend upon our banking ability. Do you agree with that?
I think that overstates. And if we did that, if we went from trying to kind of bend the relationship with China, which is what we want to do, and I give the Trump administration credit for seeing this looming tower, but we got to kind of bend this relationship without breaking it. Once you break it, you're back into that 1930s scenario where nations are erecting trade barriers, economies are splintering. How'd that work out? Well, it creates a global depression. In other words, Matt's theory of the case, I think perhaps we could initially do that, but the blowback as the global economy kind of craters would land right here in Topeka, Kansas. So we've got to be smart about how we do it. You know, technically, could we simply shut them down? That's, I think, an arguable question. And there's two sides to it. There's kind of an economic side, just closing our markets to Chinese goods. That's a nuclear option. Or there's using cyber to go after their means of production, their deployments. Those are both extremely high risk options that would elicit very strong responses from China. Down that path doth a war lie. I think we ought to be careful before we jump at an option like that.
Now, an attack on Taiwan, I have been using the analogy to the reoccupation of the Rhineland in the 30s. What do you think of my analogy? That what ought to have happened after the reoccupation of the Rhineland and didn't led to many other things. And if Taiwan were attacked and we did not respond, I believe the same follows. Do you agree with that analysis?
I do. I think it's pretty good, particularly given the cultural aspects of it, the linguistic aspects of it. I think another pretty good analogy to look at is another real world situation that follows that analogy is what's happening in Ukraine. And you know, we used to say during communist times, it is no coincidence, comrade, that XXX. Boy, you gotta wonder about the way China is moving aggressively on Taiwan at the same time Vladimir Putin's Russia is moving very aggressively on Ukraine, because that would be a very difficult problem set for the global economy, the global world to grapple with. The one good news in this, I suppose, is I don't think China, which is the more cautious of the two actors, I don't think China is prepared to make that jump either in the immediate future because of the Olympics. They really do want to land that. And then strategically, they're not quite ready to go to full combat with the United States. Unfortunately, I think that moment is, as the book says, 2034, about 10 years from now.
But Admiral, I wonder if my reaction is simply this, that if you're President Xi or President Putin, you're looking at a White House that is perceived, rightly or wrongly, as extremely appeasement-oriented, very reluctant to use force. John Kerry and Tony Blinken, Susan Rice and Joe Biden are not hawks. None of them are hawks. I don't know anything about General Austin. I've never encountered him. How would they, what should they do to stop that? I mean, that's the weakest message possible to be messaging.
What the administration should do is three things. One is use the U.S. military, position it forward, get it in what we call in the military, set the table to send a signal. So this is why you're seeing Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyers going through the Bosphorus today into the Black Sea. This is why there's an aircraft carrier strike group operating in the South China Sea today. So set the table with the military. Number two, diplomatically send a position of strength. And that is something that has to be done both privately initially, but if you're not getting results, you ratchet that up publicly. And then number three is allies, partners, and friends. Get this out of the channel of U.S. versus China, U.S. versus Russia. Let's get our NATO partners, our Pacific partners together to face these kinds of challenges. I think they're willing to come with us, but I think they'll will be key to getting this thing done. And that means economic sanctions. So there's a military, a diplomatic, and an economic component to standing up to this kind of behavior on the part of China and Russia.
We'll continue to talk about this next week. Admiral James Stavridis, thank you. The book is 2034 if you want a preview of what's ahead, and it's not happy. Thank you, Admiral.
The fact is the internet never forgets. There has never been a more important time to protect your internet activity, your digital data. That's why I urge you to get ExpressVPN. Everything you search for, watch, or click online can be tracked back to you by big tech companies, and they do it. They match your activity to your true identity using your device's unique IP address. That's why you need to switch, and I switch, to ExpressVPN. On your computer, on your phone, every IP address is masked by a secure VPN server, which makes it harder for websites to identify me. Plus, you can use ExpressVPN on up to 5 devices simultaneously. That's why they're rated the number one VPN by CNET and Wired. So stop handing over your data to big tech companies. Go with the VPN I trust for online protection. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 extra months for free. Go to expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now to learn more.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada, and a special hello to Sparta, Tennessee, a brand new affiliate, 1050 News Talk in Sparta. Sparta, I've got your United States Senator joining me now, Senator Bill Hagerty from the great volunteer state. Senator, welcome. It's good to have Sparta join our affiliates. We're all over Tennessee now. We've invaded Tennessee.
Be popular in Tennessee. Sparta is a great city and the greatest state in the nation. So I'm delighted that you got another affiliate there. You continue strong in our home state.
It's pretty close to Nashville, I see. I don't know how the signal goes, but I know we pick up the 40, which is good. I love getting the interstates. I love picking those up.
Yep.
Senator, I want to cover two things with you. First, you and Tom Cotton, who's on a little bit later, have gotten a bunch of other senators to join in sending a letter to Christopher Wray, which I'm looking at April 13th, asking him to conduct an investigation into Dr. Colin Kahl, spelled C-O-L-I-N, capital K-H-L, who is nominated to be the Undersecretary of Defense, which is the number 3 job at the Pentagon. Why do you want the FBI to investigate Dr. Kahl?
This is something that didn't come up earlier in his hearings, but something that we uncovered. And it has to do with his unauthorized disclosure of sensitive and classified information. If you think about the seriousness of this, the gravity of the position that he seeks to hold, it's the number 3 position in the Pentagon, Hugh. When I was U.S. ambassador to Japan, I dealt with the person in the previous administration that had that position on highly confidential situations, national security situations on a regular basis. The person that holds this job is going to have to be someone who completely understands and appreciates the important nature of sensitive information. And the type of information that it appears he's disclosed is the kind that would have to be dealt with in the most discreet manner, covered. Carried only by the most secure means of courier. And here he is putting it out on Twitter. It really seems to you like there's a different standard if you're Hillary Clinton or Colin Kahl than if you were, say, you know, another member of the administration in a Republican administration. We need to get to the bottom of this.
Have you heard back from Director Wray?
He just received the letter this morning, so I've not heard back yet, but I'm certain that he will take this very seriously. This is the kind of thing that would prevent a person from getting a security clearance. And you probably saw this over the weekend, Hugh, but the new UN ambassador to our United States UN ambassador, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, chief of staff, had to step aside because her security clearance was revoked for disclosing sensitive information. And her actions pale in comparison to what Kahl has done. Kahl went up on Twitter to disseminate this information that we're concerned about.
Now, are you sure it's classified, Senator? Do you believe that what he put on Twitter genuinely is classified?
That's why we want to have a full investigation. It certainly appears that way to me. As I mentioned, as U.S. Ambassador to Japan, I was a member of the previous administration. I regularly dealt with information of this type. And if you look at what he disclosed, I mean, the one that strikes me most personally, Hewitt, is what he talked about with North Korea. I mean, I was U.S. Ambassador to Japan while the situation with North Korea was raging. And in December of 2017, you remember North Korea had launched 2 intercontinental ballistic missiles over Japan at that point. We have 250,000 Americans in Japan. The largest contingent of U.S. military anywhere outside the United States is based there in Japan. Kim Jong-un is launching missiles over Japan, and here's Cole's tweet. He says he's talking about a report of what's happening in the White House as we're considering military options. Cole tweets out on December 20th, "This report should be taken very seriously." Quote, here's his quote. "There is a contingent at the White House that believes a limited strike is viable and the U.S. can control escalation by threatening regime change if Kim Jong-un retaliates. Very dangerous thinking." That is our military posture with respect to a very hot situation. This needs to be investigated very closely. He's putting this on Twitter.
I will continue that conversation with Senator Cotton as well. But while I have you, Senator Hagerty, I want to take up your expertise as ambassador to Japan. I just talked with Admiral Stavridis about the what would follow a Chinese attack on Taiwan, and it's not pretty. But a senior Japanese diplomat had occasion to tell me fairly recently that if Taiwan is attacked, the Senkaku Islands would fall soon thereafter. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that the behavior of China is most evident in Taiwan right now. Their incursions on Taiwanese airspace are regular. It's very similar to what the Chinese are doing in the Senkaku Island. It's all in the same general vicinity. So I appreciate the Japanese concern. I think we all are very concerned about what's happening in Taiwan, and I think the U.S. is going to stand strong. I've been pleased with the Biden administration's posture.
Why are you pleased? Because I have not seen – I know they're running the McCain between Taiwan and China, and I know that we have done other things, but I've also seen some incredible signals of weakness, such as the non-response to Anchorage, where the insults from the Chinese emissary were numerous and public.
Yes.
I saw a couple of stories floated about boycotting the Olympics, and then they were pulled back. I saw a story float about pulling strategic ambiguity away and actually substituting in strategic clarity about our intent to defend, if necessary, by force Taiwan. I'm not really encouraged by Team Biden, Senator.
Well, I think they started out on a bad footing, particularly with respect to China. If you think about it, they pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accord. I mean, China has no obligations to this for decades, and it immediately puts us at a disadvantage. Then they canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. Where's that oil going to go? It's going to go from Canada straight over to China, lowering their production costs. China's laughing all the way to the bank on this. And we saw what happened, as you mentioned, in Alaska, where China took a position, I think, that was very insulting. I don't think that our diplomatic team should have even taken an open meeting like that with media there, and they should have got, they should have just stepped up and walked away. I think that was very, very difficult. But with respect to Taiwan, I think that the Biden administration is taking a very, a very hard look at our posture there. And I've been, as I said, I've been encouraged by the presence of our military, our Navy in the area. And I hope we continue to send a strong message to the Chinese that we're not going to tolerate their incursions in Taiwan.
Senator, if they attack Taiwan, would you expect us to sink all or most of their fleet?
I think there should be a response that would be of like kind. And depending on what the action is, I think we should take an appropriate and deliberate response that definitely shows our resolve to support and protect Taiwan.
Well, I have used the analogy to the Rhineland in the 30s. And when Germany reoccupied Rhineland, and as Admiral Stavridis said, there's a certain parallel there because of the ethnic similarities between a portion of the Taiwanese population, a portion of the mainland population. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, the Reich's excuse in the 30s to take back the Rhineland. Does that mean an actual war if they invade that?
Well, an invasion is an act of war. And I think we will have to evaluate the circumstances as they evolve. But we have treaty obligations, and we have global expectations from our allies, Hugh. We've got to stand strong at a point in time when this administration is being tested at every turn.
Well, that brings me – don't we need a clear statement that this means war? Because that's what we didn't do in the 50s in North Korea, and we ended up with an invasion. I mean, in the 40s, with Acheson leaving Korea out of our security statement, and Stalin read that as being, oh, they won't care. But so do we think – is Taiwan under our global security protection?
Well, this is an issue that I know the administration is wrestling with right now. And I've had discussions with Secretary Blinken on this matter. I think that the posture there is evolving as the situation evolves. And I'm going to continue to track it very closely.
Putin's got 80,000 troops on the Ukraine border. They're flying incursions over Taiwan. It's not that hard to imagine they're coordinating this.
The neighborhood is very challenging. You and I have talked about this before. That's the reason we have more U.S. military stationed in Japan than any place else in the world, because you've got North Korea, Russia, and China right there at your doorstep. And they are, again, I think, testing this administration at numerous turns. And we've got to stand strong and be diligent and make certain that they understand, they meaning North Korea, Russia, China, that we're going to stand with our allies. We're going to abide by our treaties. We're not going to tolerate this behavior.
Technical question, Senator, going back to your ambassadorial days. Can planes that the United States has forward stationed, not the carrier that they have there and the carriers we dispatch or the submarine, but planes that are on the ground in Japan, can they reach China?
That's something that we never discuss in terms of our military capabilities, Hugh. And I think we have a very strong posture in Japan, I'll say that, stronger than any nation in the world. But
that's interesting. We've never disclosed what aircraft we have there and its range.
I think if you even try to find out the pace and the speed at which our ships move, it'd be very difficult to get that information.
Well, I guess that's reassuring, but I was wondering if we had any F-22s there, but I'm hearing you telling me we wouldn't disclose it if we did.
I'd prefer not to be in that discussion right now, given the sensitive nature of the information.
All right, Senator Bill Hagerty, good to talk to you. I think your call and call letter is important. I'll continue the conversation with Senator Cotton when he arrives a little bit later in the hour. Don't go anywhere, America. I appreciate the senator, and I appreciate Sparta 1050 News Talk. That's why we do this throughout Tennessee and the South, Atlanta, North Carolina, Florida. We're all over the Southeast. Actually, we're all over the country. Stay tuned, America. You're listening to the news that matters when it breaks, news that you need, analysis that you want on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening this morning. Joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton from the state of Arkansas. Good morning, Senator Cotton. Welcome.
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be back on with you.
I want to begin where I left off with Senator Hagerty. You and he jointly authored a letter to Christopher Wray, head of the FBI, concerning Colin Call. For the benefit of those who've tuned in since Senator Hagerty was on, why did you send it? What do you expect to hear back from the FBI and when?
Colin Call is Joe Biden's nominee to be the number three official in the Department of Defense. But Hugh, he has a long history of injudicious, unhinged statements, not simply about left-wing policies, but about anyone who disagrees with those policies, to include Democrats. I don't think he has the temperament to be the number three official in the Department of Defense. What Senator Hagerty now highlighted is that he also appears to have mishandled classified information very early on in the Trump administration. He appears to have used his position as Joe Biden's national security advisor when Joe Biden was vice president to release sensitive information from inside National Security Council deliberation. So we have urged Christopher Wray to do a rapid investigation of this matter before the Senate considers his nomination. This nomination is so divisive and so partisan that it came out of the Armed Services Committee a couple weeks ago on a party line vote. So he obviously has very minimal support, if any, in the Senate among Republicans. I'm not even sure he has the Democrats' support to get confirmed. But if it does turn out that he mishandled classified information for partisan purposes to attack Trump administration officials, I think this nomination will be done.
Is there a hold on the nomination right now so that it may not proceed to a final vote?
Not exactly, Hugh, because of the unusual nature of the 50-50 Senate and the split decision in the Armed Services Committee. There actually has to be what's called a motion to discharge the nomination of the Armed Services Committee, which is separate and apart from the motion to either start debate on the nomination or the confirmation vote. That hasn't happened often. Most nominees get at least one or two Republicans in committee to support it. So as it stands now, there would have to be a motion to discharge the nomination from committee, and that'd be followed by a few hours of debate and vote. So until we have that motion, we don't even have the nomination on the floor, and that's why we've urged Christopher Wray to move promptly.
Is there a procedure by which that motion is followed that will give you an early alert? Because and is it subject to filibuster, or is that a simple majority motion to discharge?
All the motions all motions and votes dealing with nominations, Hugh, are simple majority. But yes, we will have advance notice of it, because I think under the agreement that was worked out on the 50-50 Senate power sharing arrangement back in January, is that the motion to discharge gets, I believe, 4 hours of debate. So they have to file a motion. There has to be debate on it, and we have to vote on it. So this is not something that Schumer can just walk to the Senate floor and call up for a vote. So we'll know if there's going to be a vote. And frankly, if it's a 50-50 split and even one Democrat says that they want to get the results of FBI review of this matter, then they can't move to discharge it either. And I would suspect that someone like Bob Menendez, who both opposed the Iran nuclear deal that Colin Call is the most virulent defender of, and who was on the receiving end of some of Colin Call's unhinged, imbalanced comments, might want to see the results of the of an FBI review as well.
Oh, really? He attacks Senator Menendez?
He attacks anyone who doesn't want to surrender Iran to Iran, or anyone who thinks that it's important the United States show no daylight in our alliance with Israel. Colin Call, again, is an unbalanced, intemperate choice to be the number three official in the Pentagon. We're not talking about like the guy that's going to run the Census Bureau or run the Office of Personnel Management, no offense to you. We're talking about someone who's going to be the number three official in the Department of Defense. I asked him about these comments. Some of these comments he released at like 1 o'clock in the morning. I mean, do we really want someone who's sitting around on their couch, presumably at home, reading the news and unleashing unhinged statements to be the number three official in the Pentagon? And he said that, well, he got caught up in the moment and passions were running high. It's like, look, if you think passions are running high at midnight when you're sitting on your couch reviewing your news feed, what are you going to do when you're sitting in the Pentagon and China is about to invade Taiwan?
Yep. Okay. Now, Senator, let me move to that very subject because I discussed it at length with Senator Hagerty and last hour with Admiral Stavridis, the idea that China may attack Taiwan. I never really considered that as a possibility until in the last couple of years, but the last couple of weeks have seen numerous incursion of Chinese warplanes into Taiwan airspace. They've seen the Chinese send their aircraft carrier between Japan and Okinawa, and they've seen we transit our destroyers, including the John McCain, is in that channel between Taiwan and mainland China today as we speak. The opportunities are growing for a miscalculation or an outright attack. What would be the United States response, or ought to be the United States response, to any attack on Taiwan, Senator Cotton?
Well, so first, Hugh, let's set the table a little. You are correct that China has conducted feints and reconnaissances in force over the last several weeks to a degree we have not seen before from China. This is so dangerous because it will deprive Taiwan and the United States and our allies of any kind of early warning. That's probably exactly why China wants to do it. If we all become kind of inured to 25 Chinese aircraft flying the Taiwanese airspace every day and then returning to their base, we might miss the day when they don't return to their base, but they start dropping ordnance on Taiwanese military bases. Furthermore, the loss of Taiwan, should China invade Taiwan and annex it to the mainland, would be truly catastrophic for the United States and for international peace and stability. It would be akin, Hugh, I think, to perhaps saying when Nazi Germany remilitarized the Rhineland in 1936 and France and Great Britain stood by.
Exactly the analogy I used with Admiral Stavridis, and he agreed. It would be the Rhineland all over again.
Yeah, so one, it would show that the United States does not have the resolve and the political will to deter our chief adversary from invading a democratic partner of ours, a country to whom we've been deeply committed since the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act. Second, it would give Taiwan total control over the South China Sea. They have already exerted.
You mean China? Degree. You mean China?
Yes, it'd give China, Red China, not Free China, total control over the South China Sea. They've already exerted a significant degree of control by building islands in the middle of the South China Sea and militarizing them on the Obama-Biden administration's watch. But Taiwan sits at the choke point on the northern end of the South China Sea, a sea through which more than 40% of the world's global commerce travels. They would be able to exert their total control over the South China Sea. Furthermore, that would give them naval bases outside of the so-called first island chain of Japan and Taiwan and the Philippines and a few other places that allows them to project naval power more easily all around the world. And then finally, and this is truly an example of remilitarizing Iran, which was an industrial heartland in Western Europe, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company is one of the most important companies in the world. They make 80 to 90% of the world's advanced chips. If mainland China annexes Taiwan, that means that they will then have a chokehold on the world supply of advanced semiconductors. And you're seeing what that means for Americans right now and the slowdown that you see at automobile factories, of factories being idled, because we don't have enough of those chips to even make automobiles, much less high technology equipment and devices and also weapons for our military. So it'd be a total geopolitical catastrophe. So what should we do about it? We have long maintained what's called a policy of strategic ambiguity about our posture should China invade Taiwan. That was designed in part to keep Beijing guessing. It was also designed in part to restrain rash Taiwanese decisions decades ago about potential independence. Things have changed a lot. Beijing probably has the capability through the People's Liberation Army to invade Taiwan today. So the only question they have is, will the United States come to Taiwan's aid? We need to eliminate any doubt about that question. Second, Taiwan is not a military autocracy anymore. Taiwan is one of the most vibrant democracies in the world, and we need to stand up for our Taiwanese democratic partners. So the end state would still be the same. We want no change in the status quo between China and Taiwan, no forcible or non-peaceful change to that status quo. It's just the means to get to that end state would change from one of strategic ambiguity, not being quite clear about what we would do, to strategic clarity, saying simply, we will come to Taiwan's defense should China attack.
If they did attack, do you think we have the ability to sink much or most of the Chinese fleet?
Yes. The PLA probably has the ability to execute the operation to invade and annex Taiwan if it's simply China versus Taiwan. That is not a capability they had 20 or 25 years ago when Bill Clinton sent two carriers to the strait. Today, Beijing's political leaders probably believe that their military can execute that operation if it's just China versus Taiwan. If it's Taiwan and the United States versus China, if you add other democratic allies as well, then no, they do not have the ability to execute that operation, which is why they wouldn't conduct it in the first place, and why deterrence through a policy of strategic clarity about our commitment to Taiwan's democracy is the best policy to maintain peace and stability.
Now, Senator, I asked Admiral Stavridis earlier, he demurred as to the number of submarines we have in the South China Sea, and Senator Hagerty demurred on the kind of planes we keep in Japan. But the ability to strike a crushing blow against the Chinese Navy is something we've got to advertise, I think, if we want them to believe it. Do you think we actually have that capacity to strike a crushing blow against what is now a 360-ship combat force?
Yes, Hugh, and I agree with what Stav and Senator Hagerty said about not getting into specific details. But if Joe Biden and Lloyd Austin make it plain that our military is prepared to defend Taiwan's democracy and that we have the ships and the aircraft posture in the Western Pacific to do so, then I believe Xi Jinping will think twice about ever conducting that invasion. If we hem and haw, if we beat around the bush, if we hedge and we trim and we try to suggest that we don't want to ever get to that point, then Xi Jinping is more likely to go for the jugular. And look, and I know that you've heard testimony from the Armed Services Committee or committee you like I have that says this is a five-year problem, maybe. It's not a 10 or 20-year problem. I know Stav's book is entitled 2034. It's a great work of fiction. I encourage everyone to read it. I think it's even more urgent than that.
I do too.
I'll tell all your listeners this analogy. The Sochi Olympics ended in 2014 on February 23rd. Russia invaded Crimea on February 27th. Next year, the Beijing Olympics end on February 23rd.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, Putin's got 80,000 troops in Ukraine right now on the border of the free Ukraine and from the border of the occupied Ukraine. Last quick question. Do you think President Xi and President Putin discuss these matters?
I'm not sure what those two guys discuss when they get together, but I'm sure it's nothing good for Americans. I do believe that they recognize that the United States has interest in both theaters, Europe and the Western Pacific, and to a degree, they don't have nearly as many interests that they have to tend to, and that I would not be surprised if you see opportunistic pressure placed on their interests and allies in both theaters to probe and see exactly what Joe Biden is made of and what the American response would be. That's why our only response in both theaters has to be clear-eyed, hard-nosed strength.
Senator Tom Cotton, great to talk to you as always. I appreciate the candor and the ability to succinctly state that, and I hope people are listening. We'll post the audio of that at HughHewitt.com shortly.